Well, thank you very much, Harry. Everybody went a little over time, which is not surprising, with a room full of elected officials. I wanted to give people a little bit of wide berth starting off, but we're going to need to be more disciplined moving forward if we're going to be able to cover every item. And I'll try to set the example here. I just want to address very quickly, Lamar, the issue of process that you raised at the beginning. And then we'll move on and start talking about the specifics. As I listened to your description of the House Senate bill, as well as the proposal that I put on our website, obviously there were some disagreements about how you would characterize the legislation. On the other hand, when I listened to some of the steps that you thought Republicans would be open to, I thought, well, a bunch of these things are things that we'd like to do, and in fact are in the legislative proposals. So part of the goal here, I think, is to figure out what are the areas that we do agree on, what are the areas where we don't agree, and at the end of that process, then make an honest assessment as to whether we can bridge these differences. I don't know yet whether we can. My hope is that we can, and I'm going to be very eager to hear and explore how we might be able to do so. So rather than start at the outset talking about legislative process and what's going to happen in the Senate and the House and this and that, what I'd suggest is let's talk about the substance, how we might help the American people deal with costs, coverage, insurance, these other issues. And we might surprise ourselves and find out that we agree more than we disagree. And that would then help to dictate how we move forward. It may turn out, on the other hand, there's just too big of a gulf. And then we'll have to figure out how we proceed from there. So that would be my proposal. And what I'd like to do then is to start first with something I heard everybody agree on, every single speaker, and that was the issue of cost. It is absolutely true that if all we're doing is adding more people to a broken system, then costs will continue to skyrocket, and eventually somebody's going to be bankrupt, whether it's the federal government, state governments, businesses, or individual families. So we have to deal with costs, and I haven't heard anybody disagree with that. Now, I've already indicated some statistics, but I just want to reemphasize these. More than a quarter of small businesses have reported a premium increase of 20% or more just last year. 20%. As a consequence, a lot of small businesses have dropped coverage altogether. Fewer than half of businesses with fewer than 10 workers now offer coverage. By one estimate, without health care reform, by the end of the decade, premiums for businesses would more than double in most states. And the total cost per employee is expected to rise to more than $28,000. So you can imagine what that does to hiring, what that means for incomes, and you can imagine how many families are going to be unable to afford insurance. As I mentioned earlier, I hear stories from people all the time about how these costs have very concrete impacts on their lives. I spoke to a family, the Links, from Nashville, Tennessee. They've always tried to do right by their workers with their family-run company, but they had to do the unthinkable and lay off employees because their health care costs were too high. I've talked to other business people who say, we were going to hire, but we decided not to when we got our monthly premiums. And so one of the goals that I set out very early on in this process was, how do we control costs? Now, what we have done, as I mentioned earlier, was to try to take an idea that is not just a Democratic idea, but actually is a Republican idea, which is to set up exchanges. These are pools where people can come in and get the same purchasing power as members of Congress do as part of the federal employees' health care plan, as people who are lucky enough to work with big businesses can do, because there are a lot of employees in those big businesses. What we've said is that if you join one of these exchanges, you will have choice and you'll have competition. You will have a menu of private insurance options that you'll be able to purchase, but because you're not purchasing it on your own, you're purchasing it as part of a big group, you're going to be able to get lower costs. For folks who, even with those lower costs, still can't afford coverage, we provide some subsidies. But here's what I want to emphasize, is that even without the subsidies, it's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office that the plan we put forward would lower the costs in the individual market for the average person who's just trying to buy health insurance and they're not lucky enough to work for a big company, would lower their costs by between 14% and 20%. So, Lamar, when you mentioned earlier that you said premiums go up, that's just not the case according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Mr. President, if you're going to contradict me, I ought to have a chance to. The Congressional Budget Office report says that premiums will rise in the individual market as a result of the Senate bill.
No. This is an example of where we've got to get our facts straight.
That's my point.
Exactly. So let me respond to what you just said, Lamar, because it's not factually accurate. Here's what the Congressional Budget Office says. The costs for families for the same type of coverage as they're currently receiving would go down 14% to 20%. What the Congressional Budget Office says is that because now they've got a better deal, because policies are cheaper, they may choose to buy better coverage than they have right now. And that might be 10% to 13% more expensive than the bad insurance that they had previously. But they didn't say that the actual premiums would be going up. What they said was they'd be going down by 14% to 20%. I promise you, I've gone through this very carefully with the Congressional Budget Office. And I'll be happy to present this to the press and whoever's listening, because this is an important issue.
Well, may I?
Let me just finish, Lamar. Now, what we've done is we've tried to take every single cost containment idea that's out there, every proposal that healthcare economists say will reduce healthcare costs, we've tried to adopt in the various proposals. There are some additional ideas that Republicans have presented that we think are interesting, and we also tried to include. So let me give you an example. You mentioned the idea of buying across state lines insurance. That's something that I've put in my proposal that's actually in the Senate proposal. I think that it shows some promise. You mentioned that, that Mike Enzi has previously said that he's interested in small businesses being able to pool in the equivalent of some sort of exchange. So that's where there's some overlap. But I just think it's very important to understand that what we've done is to try to take every single cost containment idea that's out there and try to adopt it in this bill. What I'd like to do is to see if we can proceed and have a very concrete conversation about what are the ideas that you guys have that you don't think are in our bill to contain costs. And what I want to do is to see if maybe we can adopt some of those or refine what we've already done in order to further reduce costs.
Mr. President, I've had my
time. And what I'd like to do also is to make sure that you maybe suggest some of the ideas that are currently in the bill that you think are good. Because, Lamar, in your opening introduction, what I saw was, sort of the usual critique of why you thought it was bad. But as I said, we've adopted a lot of the ideas that we've heard from your side of the aisle. So I hope maybe you could say, well, those are the ones that we think are good ideas. Here are the things that we think are bad ideas, as opposed to just painting in broad brush. Go ahead.
Mr. President, let me show some respect for my colleagues here. They're all here, eager to speak, all sure they could do a better job than I could on any of these points. And what I would like to do is get back directly to you with why I believe, with respect, you're wrong about the bill. Your bill would increase premiums, I believe. You say it wouldn't. So rather than argue with you in public about it, I'd like to put my facts down, give them to you. Maybe other colleagues will say that. As far as Mike Enzi's proposal, he's ready to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Others are. So I appreciate the opportunity that Mitch and John gave me to talk. You've made some interesting points, and why not let other members of Congress have a chance to talk?
I think it's a great idea. I'd like to get this issue settled about whether premiums are reduced before we leave today, because I'm pretty certain I'm not wrong. And, you know, you give us the information, and we're going to be here all afternoon. I promise you we'll get this settled before the day's out. All right? Mitch, who would you like to talk about costs?
Mr. President, since some liberties have been taken here, let me just make a quick observation. Then I'm going to call on Dr. Colburn to make our framing statement on the issue of cost containment. Well, one thing I think we need to be acutely aware of, ladies and gentlemen, we are here representing the American people. And Harry mentioned several polls. I think it is not irrelevant that the American people, if you average out all of the polls, are opposed to this bill by 55 to 37. And we know from a USA Today Gallup poll out this morning, they're opposed to using the reconciliation device, the short circuit approach that Lamar referred to, that would end up with only bipartisan opposition, by 52 to 39. Now, I'd like to call on Dr. Tom Colburn, who's been a practicing physician for many years, to address the cost containment issue.
Thank you. Tom. Well, Mr. President, thanks for having us do this. I think today's going to be enlightening. The first thing I would do is put out a caution to us, because what I see the Congress doing and what I saw this last year is us actually performing bad medicine. And that is that we get stuck in the idea of treating the symptom rather than treating the disease. And whether you go to Harvard or whether you go to Thomson Reuters, there's some facts we know about healthcare in America. And the facts we know is one out of every $3 that gets spent doesn't help anybody get well and doesn't prevent anybody from getting sick. The second thing we know is from the Congressional Research Service that most of the maldrivers today in healthcare come from government rules and regulations. Well, the government now directs over 60% of the healthcare in this country. And if throwing money at it and creating new government programs could solve it, we wouldn't be sitting here today, because we've done all that. It hadn't worked. So what I thought we ought to do is maybe talk about, why does it cost so much? Because the thing that keeps people from getting access to care in our country is cost. You mentioned Malia and Sasha. The fact is with young kids going to the ER, whether they have meningitis or asthma, they're going to get treated in this country. But they may get labeled with a pre-existing illness after that. And that's another thing I'd be happy to talk about at a later time. Mm-hmm. But the fact is we know how to treat acute asthma. What we don't do a good job of is preventing children from getting acute asthma. We don't do the good job of prevention. Mm-hmm. So when you break down the costs, what we know is 33% of the costs in healthcare shouldn't be there. And how do we go about doing that? And what are the components of that cost? And when you look at when it's studied, and if you look at what Malcolm Sparrow from Harvard says, he says 20% of the cost of federal government health care is fraud. That's his number. If you look at Thomson Reuters, when they look at all of this, they say at least 15% of government-run health care is fraud. Well, when you look at the total amount of health care that's government-run, you know, you're talking $150 billion a year. So tomorrow, if we got together and fixed fraud, we could cut health care 7.5% tomorrow for people in this country. So what we ought to do is do the Willie Sutton thing. We ought to go for where the money is. What's the other area? What we do know, and I'm guilty of this, Dr. Barrasso's guilty of it, Dr. Bustiani's guilty of it, is a large portion of the tests we order every day aren't for patients. They're for doctors. And the reason they're there is because we are risk-averse to the tort system and extortion system that's out there today in healthcare. And there are a lot of ways to fix that. But I just went through last night. If you add up what Thomson Reuters, which looked at all the studies that have been done and combined them in, they say between $625 billion and $850 billion a year of healthcare dollars are wasted. So it seems to me if cost is the number one thing that's keeping people from getting care, then the efforts of us as we go after cost ought to be to go to those areas where the cost is wasted. And we there's a philosophical difference in how we do that. One wants more government-centered approach to that. I would personally prefer a more patient-centered, market-oriented approach to that. But nevertheless, there's where we can come together. Just on those two areas where we could cut costs 15% tomorrow. And that's for everybody in the country. What would happen to access in this country if tomorrow everybody's health care costs went down 15%? Access would markedly increase. So what I would hope we would do is that we would go back and concentrate on the areas that have the biggest pot of gold for us. And the biggest pot of gold is we don't incentivize prevention. We don't pay rewards for a great management of chronic disease. We have a system throughout the country where we're encouraging lawsuits that aren't productive for the country, and what they actually do is cause the cost of healthcare to go through the roof. We also know there's some other real things that we ought to address. There are conflicts of interest within the medical field. There's nothing wrong with addressing those and taking those off. We know that we absolutely do not incentivize prevention. And I'm not talking about creating walking paths. I'm talking about paying people who actually do a good job to do prevention. Talking about changing the school lunch programs where it meets the needs, nutritional needs of Americans. Changing the food stamp program where it incentivizes people to eat the right things, not the wrong things. We actually create more diabetes through the food stamp program and the school lunch program than probably any other thing because we're not offering and incentivizing a great response. So I think I think it's great that we're coming together, but the gold is in where's the cost excesses? And what I would hope we would do is we would look at that and say, how do we come together and actually achieve a reduction in the extortion that goes on in this country in terms of medical malpractice? And there's lots of ways to do that without us mandating to the states. I know you have some of that in this new thoughts in terms of incentivizing states to do that. How do we do that in terms of creating an elimination of fraud? You know, when you compare the private sector fraud rates, it's 1% compared to Medicare and Medicaid. You know, there's estimates that there's $15 billion worth of fraud in Medicaid a year in New York City alone. So we haven't attacked that. We haven't gone where the money is. And my hope would be that we would look at where the money is. And if truly it's accurate, and I don't know many people that will disagree that $1 in $3 doesn't help somebody get well and doesn't prevent them, then we ought to be going for that $1 in $3. And we ought to do it not by creating a whole bunch of new government programs, but by creating an incentive to reward people. You, in your new bill, you have good fraud programs, but you lack the biggest thing to do. The biggest thing on fraud is to have undercover patients so that people know we're checking on whether or not this is a legitimate bill. And you don't know who's an undercover patient and who's not. And all of a sudden, you start changing your attitude of whether or not you're going to milk Medicare or you're going to milk Medicaid. So,
Mr. President, if I could just say that I'm not an expert on much, but I am filibusters. And we have 40 members of Congress
Tom, you made some powerful points. You want to just wrap up real quick?
No, I'll just finish with that. Is with $1 out of $3 not helping everybody, we ought to go for where it is.
Well, Tom, I appreciate what you said. I think we're going to have Steny Hoyer go next. I just want to make this quick point. Every good idea that we've heard about reducing fraud and abuse in the Medicare and Medicaid system, we've adopted in our legislation. So that's an example of where we agree. We want to eliminate fraud and abuse within the government systems. Let's recognize, though, that those savings in the government systems, which will help taxpayers and allow us to do more, doesn't account for the rising costs in the private marketplace. Now, the private marketplace, you mentioned the issue of medical malpractice and frivolous lawsuits, and I, as you indicated, these are areas where Secretary Sebelius has already begun to try to give states some incentives to do that. On the prevention side, there's a whole host of provisions inside the legislation that's been passed by the House and the Senate, and I think Steny will talk about it. So we've identified some areas we agree on, and then the question just is, does that help the average family in the individual market who potentially can get costs? But Steny,
let me just respond one thing. You get cost shifted every penny that gets wasted in Medicare. And that gets cost shifted to the private sector. So if, in fact, we're wasting it in the public sector, we're shifting it to the private sector.
You and I agree on this. Steny?
Mr. President, thank you very much. A quote I will use is, we should have available and affordable health care to every American citizen, to every family. I suppose there are a whole lot of every Americans and American families listening to us today and watching us. And they're hoping that we're all sitting around here talking about them, not about us. That's the message they're sending to all of us. And they're absolutely correct. And we believe that we have been addressing them and trying to get some of these stories that all of us hear to a place where they won't be so tragic for individuals and for families. Every one of us has a story. I had a message on my telephone answering machine just a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago. Woman that I know well called me up. She said, Steny, I was just diagnosed with a tumor, and I've got to be operated on. I don't have any insurance. My husband makes $28,000. I work part-time and make about $5,000. She says, we're making too much money for Medicaid, and we're going to go to the University of Maryland Hospital. They want 50% down of a $25,000 bill. She doesn't have that. And we're working on that, trying to get her some additional help. Hopefully we can. I had a small business in my district, like all of you, who last year paid $1,100. Couple, healthy, paid $1,100. Their bill is going to go up to $1,830 next year. That's a 67% increase. They called me up and said, we don't know that we can afford to keep our small business going. So all of us, John McCain, my good friend, that was your quote, as you probably recall, in the debate that you had with President Obama. And the good thing was that both of you, in effect, said the same thing, that we need to get to the objective of covering all Americans and having them have access to affordable health care. We agree with that. I think probably everyone around this table agrees to it. So what we're going to talk about is the how. Cost containment is clearly one of those issues that we need to deal with. Cost containment for that small business that is having a 67% increase. Cost containment for that woman who can't afford insurance but has a health care issue that she can't avoid. It's not optional for her. So we have to deal with that. Many in my caucus believe that one way of doing that is to increase competition, to have an open, free market that is transparent. I think all of us around this table agree that a free market does that, an open market, a transparent market where people can compare prices and compare what they're going to get. And that's what we've tried to do in both these bills. Did a little differently, but that's what we tried to do. We hope we can get agreement on doing that. An open, transparent market will bring down costs, we believe. And in addition to that, Senator Coburn, we certainly agree with you that $1 in $3 is not being spent as effectively as it should be. And we have a lot of provisions in both bills, as you well know, that try to get us to a place where administrative costs, health information technology, so many other things are done to wring the costs out. And in addition, you speak eloquently and correctly about wringing fraud, waste, and abuse out of this system. I know you're happy to have seen in our bill, in the House bill and in the Senate bill, very substantial investment in doing just what you suggest. So I think we have agreement on conflict of interest in delivery of medicine as well. We've dealt with that in our bill. We've dealt with it previously, as you well know. We've put incentives for prevention in here, which you mentioned. We absolutely agree on that. We think this bill does that. Now, you may have a better way of doing it. We need to talk about how that better way is. But we certainly have addressed the issue of making sure that we have wellness as a focus, not sickness. We have to deal with sickness, but what we really want is wellness. So we've worked very hard on that in this bill. You mentioned the school lunch and food stamp programs. I'm sure we can get there, too, in agreement. We certainly agree with the premise you stated. We'll figure out the way and means to get there. What have we done? We've stopped premium discrimination. That clearly ups cost. If you're in a small market, as the president pointed out, you're going to pay a higher price. We don't do that. Why? Because we're in a big market. We have a competitive edge, and the insurance company doesn't have pre-existing conditions for us. They just take us as a group. That's what we're trying to get for every American, that they have access to a large group, whether they're an individual, this woman who has the tumor, or whether they're a small business. They can get into a large group. We're trying to do that. We want to go after fraud, waste, and abuse. I'll reiterate that. Transparent market, stop premium discrimination, and make sure that people with a pre-existing condition, as none of us have a problem with, but a lot of people do have, because we're in a big group, that are in a large group, and we prohibit that. You agree with that rhetorically. Now, it's not in your legislation, but you certainly agree with capping out-of-pocket expenses on an annual basis or lifetime basis, that you don't think that's right, that people ought to continue to be covered. We believe there needs to be better coordination of care. You're a doctor. You have a number of doctors in the room. We believe that there ought to be a way that we can incentivize the coordination of care. We also believe that there should be incentives to provide care based upon best practices, not based upon simply procedures being reimbursed. I think we all agree on that. You're shaking your head in agreement, and I know we all agree on that. And you're right. We have to get there. But I would suggest to you that one of the things that many in my caucus felt very strongly about in terms of competition was having a public option. Now, there was real disagreement on that issue, but many in my caucus thought that would open up competition, would provide for access for every citizen if they didn't have access in some other way. Now, Senator Baucus is going to speak at more specifically in terms of our cost containment, but donut hole certainly is one of the issues that we need to deal with. Donut hole, we deal with in our legislation in the House. We would hope that it is in legislation that we agree upon, because seniors are confronted with extraordinary out-of-pocket costs for a very significant portion of the cost of their prescription drug. And seniors are concerned about that. We take care of that in our bill. But I think what the American public that's listening and watching expects us to do, Mr. President, is what you're doing, bringing us together, coming to agreement to make sure that we get to a place where we reach the objective that President Obama and candidate McCain expressed as the objective on behalf of the American people. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
You know, before you go, Max, I just want to ask whether it's you, Tom, or anybody else on the Republican side, and maybe some of the House members might be interested. You know, Senator Coburn mentioned some cost containment issues where it sounds like we agree. Fraud and abuse, we agree. It sounds like you have maybe one other idea that you don't think is in our proposal, but the idea of undercover patients, but that's something that I'd be very interested in exploring. I don't think conceptually that would be a problem. The issue of prevention, that includes, by the way, things like the how our kids are eating and getting exercise, and I'm proud of the First Lady for working to see what she can do on that front. And there are some provisions in the legislation that's already been passed through the Senate and the House that directly relate to this that I think you'd be supportive of. The issue of defensive medicine, as I indicated, Secretary Sebelius is working on this, but I think that there are things that we could do at the state level to help foster innovation and eliminate some of the concerns that you've got. I would be interested in hearing from any of our Republican colleagues what objections they have to what we consider one of the biggest ways of driving down costs. And that's what Steny just referred to, which is allowing individuals and small businesses who are currently trapped in a very expensive market, essentially they're having to be out there fending for themselves, to be able to buy into essentially a large group, to become part of a large group, just like all of us as government employees are part of a large group, so that they have more negotiating power with the insurance companies, which I think we all agree would drive down costs. You know, if you've got some bigger purchasing power, insurance companies want more customers, they would drive down those costs. I know some of you have agreed to this as a concept in the past, and so my question is there something in terms of the way the House and Senate bills have been structured that leads you to be concerned or want to not move forward on that approach? John?
Well, Mr. President, I'd like to yield to Mr. Klein from Minnesota, who will talk about the small business health plans in terms of how we would propose to do this.
Thank you, Leader. Thank you, Mr. President. I think that Senator Alexander framed our overall position very well when he said that we're looking at thousands of pages of legislation, and we believe a better approach is to go step by step to address these issues of cost. We certainly agree that you get better economies of scale if you can come together. We have proposed in both the House and the Senate, in fact, for a number of years, that small businesses be able to band together in small business health plans or association health plans. We all know, and I've heard everybody say here, that small businesses are the engine that drives our economy. We also know that about half of the uninsured either work for small businesses or depend upon somebody who does. And so we believe that we ought to address that issue by allowing these small businesses to band together in the same way that I think, Mr. President, you mentioned, large companies do. And I mean really the same way. Mm-hmm. So that they get all the advantages of, if they self-insure, being able to avoid the 50 state mandates, being able to lower their administrative costs because they're not having to deal with that. And it will lower the cost of premiums for these small businesses and allow them to insure more people and to keep people they're already insured on the books, because we all know stories like we've heard here of small businesses that are saying, I can no longer provide insurance for my employees. Yeah. Small businesses have been asking for this for years. It's not a new idea.
Right.
They've been asking for it for years, and we think it's a far better way to get these economies of scale than the exchange thing that's in the huge bill. This will actually allow businesses to be able to lower their costs exactly the same way that large businesses do.
Okay. Max is going to go, and then I'll go to you, Rob. Max, do you want to address this issue of how we can allow people to buy into large groups, how the Senate bill accomplishes it, and I don't know if you want to remark on what John just said.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I'd though first like to say something that just strikes me just in spades. Frankly, we all studied this issue a lot, health care reform. We basically know what the problems are, all of us. We basically know the need, the current system is unsustainable. We are actually quite close. There's not a lot of difference. Close in the sense, without being corny and dramatic about this, that the American people want us to do something that's basically reasonable. It doesn't have to be one congressman, one senator's provision, but basically reasonable. We are on the verge and the cusp with not too much effort to try to bridge a lot of gaps here, because the gaps, in my judgment, are not that great. Let's take the list, for example, that Lamar mentioned. As you said, Mr. President, we are basically including most of those provisions, if not all, in our joint legislation. Selling insurance across state lines, for example, we allow for that, not exactly in the way that some would, but sure, with compacts, and once state exchanges are up, people will be able to buy and sell insurance across state lines and achieve that competition. In addition, you mentioned lawsuits. Secretary Sebelius is working to try and find ways to encourage states to settle, resolve issues before they become big, bad lawsuits. Add to that, Lamar says we should find ways for states to be able to lower their costs, so we do that. We let states opt out. They can do what they want to do. And Senator Wyden also has a proposal. Senator Cantwell has a proposal. We give a lot of flexibility in that regard. Expand HSAs. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with HSAs. But we also have to have products for poorer people, lower-income people. HSAs work pretty well if you have middle or high-income. Pre-existing conditions, clearly, we all agree on that. We have those provisions in our bill. Respect to small business, we're not that far apart. Some suggest association health plans, where small business people can band together in an association pool and get better insurance. That's fine. What we provide for in our legislation is something similar. It's called the SHOP Act. Various senators, bipartisan, have worked on this. And basically, it allows sets up a small business arrangement in exchanges. Small business participates in their own exchange and gets the advantage of all the pooling. And then they can do what federal employees do today. They can shop and compare and to get the best deal. And I would guess that most small businessmen would like to do that. I might add that we're also providing tax incentives, tax credits for businesses, small business, that wants to purchase health insurance for its employees. And it's pretty good. It's 35% tax credit first couple of years. Then once the exchange is up, it's 50%. So the main point is we're not really that far apart. We're trying to find ways for small business to pool, small business to take advantage of competition, to shop and compare, and also some tax provisions that enable to encourage businesses to get health insurance. So I might say, too, that if you look at all the provisions, and Stanley outlined many of them, we agree on prevention. There are major prevention provisions in our legislation, as Senator Colburn mentioned. We also agree on trying to change the way we reimburse docs. I think the biggest game changer here, frankly, is how we reimburse our doctors. They're based more on quality rather than quantity. I know Tom Colburn really agrees with that as a doctor. And most doctors do. And it's another example we really are close. And I think that once we keep pushing on those areas that we're close, it's going to make a difference. The exchanges, as you mentioned, Mr. President, it's a Republican idea. It works. What I like about exchanges, it's like Orbitz. It's like Expedia. You know, you go to Orbitz or Expedia to buy an airline ticket, you compare it, get the best price. That's basically what this is. It's an exchange. You go to the exchange, you shop around, and you get your best price. That's going to help, in my judgment. I also think that we should, where the hospitals should publish the cost of their basic procedures, whether it's an appendectomy or colonoscopy or whatnot, to enable consumers to shop around. Where's the best price? We all know that there's a wide disparity in what hospitals charge for the same procedures. Let's, you know, I think disinfectant of sunshine helps. It helps consumers. It helps our people. And fraud and waste, we've talked about that. We have major provisions in our bill to fraud and waste. Mr. President, I compliment you because in your proposal, you can go even farther.
We took some additional ideas from folks Congressman Roskam.
They're great ideas. And we addressed the unnecessary readmission rates, from hospitals, et cetera. The main point is we basically agree. There's not a lot of difference here. And I just like us to kind of just, it's an opportunity for us to work out some of these differences.
Mitch, is there somebody?
Mr. President, I'm going to yield to John here.
John?
I'd like to yield to Dave Kemp, continue this conversation about cost containment.
Dave.
Thank you, Leader Boehner, and thank you, Mr. President, for the invitation today. I think as we focus this part of the conversation on cost, a lot of Americans say to me, if you're really interested in controlling costs, well, maybe you shouldn't be spending $1 trillion on health care, as the Senate and House bills do. Also, cutting Medicare benefits by $500 billion to fund this new entitlement is, I think, a step in the wrong direction, and many Americans do as well. The nonpartisan actuaries at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services say on page 4 of their letter on the Senate-passed bill that it would bend the cost curve in the wrong direction by about $250 billion. They specifically say the health expenditures under the Senate bill would increase by $222 billion. A key way of reducing costs that's missing from the House and Senate bills is responsible lawsuit reform that guarantees injured parties, much like our two largest states have adopted, Texas and California, access to all economic damages, such as future medical care. If they need nursing care in the future, they'll get it. Lost wages, reasonable awards for punitive damages and pain and suffering. On page 4 of its letter to Senator Hatch, CBO found that this common sense reform would reduce the federal deficit by more than $50 billion. Now, that's just on the government side, because as we know, CBO doesn't score the private side on this. And PricewaterhouseCoopers has done a study that said savings could be as high as $239 billion if this reform were adopted. There are two features in the House and Senate bills that move in the wrong direction. Both bills feature restrictions on health spending accounts where people can save tax-free for their health care, as well as FSAs, flexible spending accounts. These changes are such as they ban the use of over-the-counter medication out of both of these plans. There's a new cap on FSA contributions of $2,500. That text, that language is found on page 1,959 of the Senate bill, and that will hinder the growth of those plans, and which encourage Americans to consider quality and price when they purchase health care. And let me just say, under HSA plans, premiums increased just 1.3% for individuals in 2007 to 2008 and declined 5.4% for families in that same period. And when people switch from a PPO, a preferred provider organization, to a health savings account, their premiums declined by an average of $3,800. Now, another concern I have is the Senate bill, which on page 982 creates an unelected board charged with recommending even more Medicare reductions. And if Congress doesn't accept these recommendations, they have to find other Medicare spending to cut instead. And that gives, I think, too much authority to unelected bureaucrats rather than to elected representatives of the people. And the power to decide whether to cut Medicare and by how much. Now, holding down health care costs for the government is important, but I think it's also important to hold down costs for families and employees.
Dave, I don't mean to interrupt, but we're going to have the whole section talking about deficits, and we can talk about the changes in Medicare. We were trying to focus on costs related to lowering families. And you know, the only concern I've got is, look, if every speaker, at least on one side, is going through every provision and saying what they don't like, it's going to be hard for us to see if we can arrive at some agreements on things that we all agree on. So I don't want to try to cut you off. Please finish up, but I just want to kind of point out that
I do want to say on this issue on premiums, CBO in their letter on page 4 does say that the estimated average premium per person for non-group policies would increase by 10 to 13%.
This is the discussion that I just had about Lamar.
Yes, they do say that, and they do say that the value of the benefit is higher, and that is why it goes up. But right. The reason the value of the benefit is higher is because of the mandates contained in the legislation. And this is one of our big concerns with a lot of the issues that have been raised. Yes, we have similarities, but when all of this is structured around a government-centered exchange that sets the standard for these policies, states can't get out of these requirements unless they seek a waiver from the secretary. That kind of approach raises costs, and so both of your comments were correct that costs do go up, and it's because they have a richer benefit, but the reason it's richer is because of the mandates contained in these very large bills.
Okay, I'm going to let Rob, feel free to respond to anything that Dave indicated or to any of the other issues that have been discussed.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to thank my friend Tom Coburn and John Klein for the spirit of conversation which they offered and try to carry that forward a little bit. The President asked at the beginning of this, what ideas do we share about cutting costs? And Tom, I think you had some very good ones. Fraud, that the President has a proposal that says we should have a database. If you've committed fraud against Medicare once, you can't make a contract again. Wellness, there's a lot of good ideas in the bills. Junk lawsuits, I think that there's what Secretary Sebelius is doing is very important in curtailing that. And then the President asked the question about whether we can find agreement on pooling the purchasing power of small businesses and individuals so they can get the same deal that big companies and members of Congress get. And my friend John Klein talked about the Association Health Plan proposal. Respectfully, John, I think that what you're talking about with association health plans and what we're talking about with exchanges is a semantic difference. It's a matter of pooling the purchasing power of small businesses and individuals to get a better deal. But there is one substantive difference that I want to ask about because we are concerned about it. If we can resolve this, I think we could agree. Let's take the case of a woman who has a baby by C-section. And she lives in one of the many states that say you can't be kicked out of the hospital after you've had a C-section until your doctor thinks it's time for you and the baby to go home. Now, under the Association Health Plan proposal, that rule wouldn't apply to that lady and her baby, that there would be no protection of her in that situation. We think, John, that there shouldn't be necessarily, 51 different rules for each state. But there ought to be some minimum federal standards in these exchanges to protect people in cases like that. So I think the issue is if we could find a way to agree that in a case like this where, a lady has a baby by C-section and has the ability to not have the insurance company get between her and her doctor, so the doctor makes a decision about when they go home, we could figure this out. And
if I could just respond to that, my friend knows very well that there are large companies today who operate under what I'm proposing for association health plans. They get a waiver. They don't have to comply with the individual mandates of all 50 states. And right. I don't hear people complaining about the insurance policies that they're getting from their big companies. In fact,
well, we do.
Many of those okay. Now would fall into what we've been calling Cadillac plans because they provide very excellent service. So I think that, frankly, is a red herring. And I think that you're not going to have adequate coverage if you have an association health plan that's working under the same rules as a large company.
Would you favor a standard that says they have to do something like that, or would we just leave it up to the insurance company?
I would say that we put the association health plans in exactly the same position that large companies are today, with exactly the same rules under ERISA.
With all respect, we don't agree with that. We don't agree with the idea that the insurance company should get to make that kind of decision about whether the lady goes home Thursday or Sunday. Now, I don't think that's intrusive. I think that makes common sense. But if we could find a way to bridge that gap, and I think we could, then I think the AHPs that you support aren't all that different than the exchanges that we do, and I would think that would be a common ground.
Good. This has been a useful conversation. Paul Ryan wants to make a
President,
comment.
Can I just interject one quick point here, very quick, just in terms of trying to keep everything fair, which I know you want to do. To this point, the Republicans have used 24 minutes, the Democrats 52 minutes. Let's try to have as much balance as we can.
I think the Republican leaders are controlling the time for the Republicans, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
I don't think that's quite right, but I'm just going back and forth here, Mitch. I think we're just trying to go back and forth, but that's okay. Paul, I was about to call on you, if that's all right. Go ahead.
All right. Rob, here's basically what we're looking at. The difference is this. We don't think all the answers lie in Washington regulating all of this. So the problem with the approach we're seeing that you're offering, which I do believe, Senator, is very different than what we're saying, is we don't want to sit in Washington and mandate all of these things. So what you're is you're defining exactly what kind of health insurance people can have. You're mandating them to buy this kind of health insurance. And so we simply say, look, if the National Restaurant Association or the National Federation of Independent Business, on behalf of their members,
right,
wants to set up an association health plan, we think they'll probably do a good job on behalf of their members. Let them decide to do that instead of restricting insurance competition. By federalizing the regulation of insurance and by mandating exactly how it will work, you make it more expensive and you reduce the competition among insurers for people's business. We want to decentralize the system, give more power to small businesses, more power to individuals, and make insurers compete more. But if you federalize it, standardize it, and mandate it, you do not achieve that. And that's the big difference we have.
Paul, would you yield? Mr. President, may I ask him to yield?
We're not in a formal hearing here. Okay. So go ahead.
Paul, I read your roadmap, and I thought one of the things that you said is that there should be some minimum consumer protections in the exchanges that you proposed. Did I get that wrong?
And there are in every state. And so what we're simply saying is, look, lots of us have offered lots of different ideas. We've got dozens of Republican ideas offered in the House, in bills, in the Senate. And many of us look at the point of the fact that the states, you know, do we distrust our governors? Do we distrust our state legislatures? Do we distrust all the state insurance? Yeah, okay, some of you may do that.
Depends on who it is,
but should we regulate all this? Should four people in Washington decide exactly how this works and what you can and cannot buy?
Paul,
there's just a difference in philosophy.
No, look. This is an important point. We've got a couple other people who want to speak. We've gone about 45 minutes on this section. We're running over because we went long on the opening statements. And you're right, there was an imbalance on the opening statements because I'm the president. And so I made, I didn't count my time in terms of dividing it evenly. In this section, Mitch, we've gone back and forth
Senator
pretty
Schumer
well.
For the Senate.
I know Senator Schumer wants to speak, and I know that Jim Clyburn wants to say something very quickly, and you guys may want to.
John Kyle would like to.
And
as
John.
Well.
But what I want to do, though, is just focus in on this philosophical debate. This is a legitimate debate. And it actually speaks to the point that Congressman Camp was making earlier about what's happening in the exchanges. You know, when I was young, just got out of college, I had to buy auto insurance. I had a beat up old car. And I won't name the name of the insurance company, but there was a company, let's call it Acme Insurance, in Illinois. And I was paying my premiums every month. After about 6 months, I got rear-ended, and I called up Acme and said, you know, I'd like to see if I can get my car repaired. And they laughed at me over the phone because, really, this was set up not to actually provide insurance. What it was set up was to meet the legal requirements, but it really wasn't serious insurance. Now, it's one thing if you got an old beat-up car that you can't get fixed. It's another thing if your kid is sick or you've got breast cancer. So the general idea has been here that we should set up some minimum standards within the exchange, that a plan that people are buying into, whether it's a small business or an individual, should be at least solid enough that if your kid got sick, they're actually going to be treated. That if something happened, that you weren't left with a huge bunch of out-of-pocket costs. It is true that you can always get cheaper insurance if it has really high deductibles or really high co-payments or doesn't cover as many things. And so there has to be a balance that's struck there. I just want to point out, though, that the principle of pooling is at the center of both the Senate and the House bill. And the reason I'm pointing this out is because there was a lot of talk about government takeover of health care. And the implication, I think, was that everybody was going to have to sign up for a government health care plan. Now, that's not the issue. What the issue here, which we've had an honest disagreement about, is how much should government set a baseline versus just letting people decide that, you know, I can't really get decent insurance, but, you know, maybe this is better than nothing. And that's a legitimate argument. I don't disagree with that, but I just want to point out that when we start talking about how much government involvement is at issue here, it's not because the House or the Senate bills are a government takeover of health care. It is that the House and the Senate bills put in place some regulations that restrict how insurance companies operate, and if there's an exchange or a pool that's set up, that there's a baseline sort of minimum requirements that were expected, and I understand that there may be some philosophical differences on the other side of the aisle about that issue. Chuck, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President, and I thank you. I think this has been a constructive dialogue. I was glad to hear my friend Tom Coburn's remarks. I think we agree with most of them, and particularly the point that about a third of all of the spending that's done in Medicare, Medicaid, I would imagine a lot of it's in the private sector as well, doesn't go to really good health care, goes to other things. And the real nub of this is, how do we wring that waste out, that fraud, abuse, duplication, without interfering with the good care that we want every person on Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance to get? The average citizen knows this happens. How many times when you look at your medical bill, you've undergone a minor procedure, and you see Dr. Smith, $4,000, and you sort of vaguely remember he just waved and poked his head in the door? Or how about, probably it's happening right now, there's some salesman talking to some doctor and saying, hey, my company will finance a machine for you for $1 million. So you don't have to pay for it. You can gradually pay it. We'll show you how to fill it up all the time, and you'll increase your income by $200,000. And there's another machine three blocks away that's already working and available. So these are the things we have to go after. And Tom, I thought your suggestion of undercover patients, and I tried to check here, I don't think we do it now, is a great idea. And it's one that we can come together on. I think there are other things that we can come together on. Senator Cantwell put a provision in the Senate bill that said we ought to reward doctors for doing quality, not quantity. So that doctor, and there's a small number of doctors, that Gawande's study showed, thing in the New Yorker that I think we've all read, that a small number of people who are just trying to maximize their income throw the whole system off. It threw the whole city of McAllen, Texas off, while El Paso had much lower rates. Maria Cantwell has a provision in there, which I would think you folks could agree on, that says that we ought to reward doctors for the quality, not the quantity, not the number of times they could put someone through a machine, but how good the care is. There's a provision in there, Senator Rockefeller authored, it comes in the insurance part, that says 80 to 85% of what insurance companies put forward should go to the get money in for, should go to the patient. So I think we can do all of these things, but it does, but if we're going to eliminate the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare, it does mean we're going to cut some of that out. And when I hear my friend Dave Camp say, you cannot cut money out of Medicare, well, we don't want to cut the good stuff that you point out, or not, or prevent, add the prevention, but if we're going to, if one-third, if what Senator Coburn says, that one-third of Medicare doesn't go to patient care, you can't just get up there and say, we don't want to cut anything out of Medicare. We want to cut the bad stuff and keep the good stuff. And I think that's where we can find common ground on some of the things you've mentioned, some of the things that are in our bill. And I hope at least in this area we can move forward that way, because, frankly, the Republican Party has always stood for getting rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse in the system. In 97, it was the centerpiece of your program. And all of a sudden this year we're hearing, don't do any of that. That's something that I think we can come together on. I thank you.
Mr. President, can we turn to John? I'm sorry.
Sure. I'm sorry. You had John. So we're going to go to John, and then we're going to go to Jim Clyburn, and then I think we're going to take a break because we've run out of time. So, John.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think you framed the issue very well just a moment ago, because there are some fundamental differences between us here that we cannot paper over. And, Mr. President, when you said that this is a philosophical debate and it's a legitimate debate, I agree with that. We do not agree about the fundamental question of who should be mostly in charge. And you identified this question as central. Do you trust the states or do you trust Washington? Do you trust patients and doctors making the decision or do you trust Washington? Now, there's a mix of both, of course, in healthcare. But there is a big difference between our approaches. And there is so much in the bills that you've supported that puts control in Washington that we have a very difficult time supporting those provisions. And it's not a matter of just saying we all agree on the goal of reducing waste, fraud, and abuse. We all do, of course. It's how you do it. Now, let me give you a couple of examples. Dave Camp, I think, pointed out the answer to the dispute that you and Lamar Alexander had a moment ago, and he was exactly right. Let me quote from the Congressional Budget Office letter. This is from Doug Elmendorf to Evan Bayh, November 30th, 2009. Quote, CBO and Joint Tax Committee estimate that the average premium per person covered, including dependents, for new non-group policies would be about 10% to 13% higher in 2016 than the average premium for non-group coverage in the same year under current law. Oliver Wyman, a very respected third-party group, says it's even more, about 54% in my state of Arizona, 72% increase. Why is it so? For a variety of reasons, but one of which both you and Dave Camp agreed on. It is a richer benefit. How did it get that way? Because the federal government would mandate it under your legislation in the insurance exchanges. And as a result, there would be a higher cost. How does this happen? There is an actuarial requirement of 60% actuarial value in the exchange for the least costly plan. But the average in the country today of a high deductible plan is 48%. The range today is 40 to 80%, and the average is between 55 and 60. So what the government is doing here is saying, we're going to mandate that the insurance cover more things than it does right now, and therefore the cost is going to go up. Second example, you say, how can we help small businesses? Well, we know one way you don't help small businesses is by raising the payroll, the Medicare payroll tax on them, which is what this legislation does. Besides that, it's a job killer. Look at the taxes on beneficiaries as well. This is a third example. You don't cut costs when you raise taxes on medical devices that help us, when you raise taxes on pharmaceutical products, when you raise taxes on the insurance premiums themselves. Quote, these fees on insurers, medical devices, and pharmaceuticals would increase costs for the affected firms, which would be passed on to purchasers and would ultimately raise insurance premiums by a corresponding amount. Congressional Budget Office. So when you raise these taxes, and all of the different fees that are in this legislation, it inevitably increases the costs on the consumer. And why do you have to raise all of this money? Because of the expenses of the legislation that underlie all of this. That's why Republicans would rather start not by having to raise a lot of money in order to pay the high cost of this bill, but to start a piece at a time directing solutions to specific problems. That way you don't incur all of the costs up front, which require you to raise the taxes. Last quick point. One of the worst things about this is for people that have catastrophic medical expenses today, after you've spent 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, you can deduct that. This bill would raise that to 10%. Who does that hurt? The very people you promised, Mr. President, that you wouldn't allow taxes to be raised on. Average age, 45. Average income, $69,000. These are not wealthy people. Just another example of why, because the bill has to raise so much money, it ends up hurting the very people that we want to help.
Okay. John, I'm going to go to you, Jim, but since, as has tended to happen here, we end up talking about criticisms of the existing bill as opposed to where we might find agreement, I feel obliged just to go through a couple of the points that you raised. Just to go back to the original argument that Lamar and I had, and we've now chased around for quite some time. Look, if I'm a self-employed person who right now can't get coverage or can only buy the equivalent of Acme insurance that I had for my car, so I have some sort of high deductible plan. It's basically not health insurance, it's house insurance. I'm buying that to protect me from some catastrophic situation, otherwise I'm just paying out of pocket. I don't go to the doctor, I don't get preventive care. There are a whole bunch of things I just do without. But if I get hit by a truck, maybe I don't go bankrupt. All right, so that's what I'm purchasing right now. What the Congressional Budget Office is saying is that if I now have the opportunity to actually buy a decent package inside the exchange that costs me about 10 to 13% more but is actually real insurance, then there are going to be a bunch of people who take advantage of that. So, yes, I'm paying 10 to 13% more because instead of buying an apple, I'm getting an orange. They're two different things. Now, you still have an option. Let me finish. The way that this bill is structured uses a high cost pool, a catastrophic pool, for people who can't afford to buy that better insurance. But overall, for a basic package, which, by the way, is a lot less generous than we give ourselves in Congress. So, you know, I'm amused when people say, you know, let people have this not-so-good plan. Let them have a high deductible. But there'd be a riot in Congress if we suddenly said, let's have Congress have a high deductible plan. Because we all think it's pretty important to provide coverage for our families. And the federal health insurance program has a minimum benefit that all of us take advantage of. And I haven't seen any Republicans or Democrats in Congress suddenly say, you know what, we should have more choices and not have to have this minimum benefit. So what we're basically saying is we're going to do the same thing for these other folks that we do for ourselves, on the taxpayer's dime, by the way. Now, there is a legitimate philosophical difference around that. But I think it's just very important for us to remember that saying there's a baseline of coverage that people should be able to get if they're participating in this big pool is not some radical idea. And it's an idea that a lot of states, you know, we were talking earlier about what states do. A lot of states already do it. This, by the way, goes to the other difference that we have when it comes to interstate purchase of insurance. Actually, this is a Republican idea, been championed by the Republicans. We actually agree with the idea that maybe if you get more regional markets and national markets as opposed to just state-by-state markets, you might get more choice and competition. People would be able to say, gosh, there's a great insurance company in Nevada, and I live in New York, and maybe I can purchase it. That's actually something that we find attractive. So do you guys. But again, the one difference, as I understand it, and the reason you're not supporting the approach that we take, is what we say is there should be sort of a minimum baseline benefit, because if not, what ends up happening is you can have a company set up in Nevada. Let's assume there were no rules there. There are no protections for the woman who's got breast cancer. They go into New York. They offer pretty cheap insurance to everybody who's healthy. They don't offer the same insurance to people who aren't so healthy or have pre-existing conditions. They drain from New York all the healthy people who are getting cheaper rates, but now suddenly everybody left in New York who doesn't qualify for that cheaper plan is in a pool that's sicker, older, and their premiums go up. So what we've said is, well, if we can set a baseline, then you can have interstate competition, but it's not a race to the bottom. Rather, everybody's got some basic care. Now, these are legitimate arguments to have, but I just want to point out that this issue of government regulation, and which we're going to also be talking about with respect to insurance, is very different than the way this has been framed during the course of the debate over the last year, which is government takeover of insurance. This is not a government takeover of insurance. What it is saying, let's set up some baselines and then use market principles, the private sector, and pooling in order to make sure that people get a better deal. So, Jim, and then what we're going to do is we're just going to move on to the next topic, but anybody who wants to pick up on what we've just talked about obviously can return to that as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, leaders and members of the Congress. There are two cost containment issues that I think have not been sufficiently vetted here today. Let me set this up by sharing with you a conversation I had on yesterday with the administrators of the Dillon or McLeod Healthcare Center in Dillon, South Carolina, a little town, Mr. President, you've become quite familiar with. They told me that their emergency room activities have doubled over the past several years. And they were looking for some assistance to expand the size of that emergency room. When I began to question them as to why in this small county, not in my district, they had had such a doubling, what it turns out is that they told me that 31% of the people that they treat in that emergency room are not there for emergencies. They are there for primary care. Now, they said to me that some of these people do not have health insurance, but many of them do have health insurance, but they cannot afford the $1,500 to $2,000 deductibles that they would have to pay if they were to go to a private primary care provider. So they are now treating people who've got employer-based health care that they cannot use. They're holding that for some catastrophic event, but they need some assistance. Now, I think that no matter what kind of plan we develop, there will be many people left uncovered, and we need a safety net for those people. I believe that the one way to provide that safety net and to take care of all of those people who may be uncovered and those people who have $2,000 deductibles with primary care is for a significant expansion of community health centers. And we have not spoken about that here today, but I know that your proposals, Mr. President, I know that both the House and Senate plans have that in them, and I do believe that that is very, very important. We have more than a 40-year experience with these healthcare centers, and I do believe that no matter what we do, there ought to be a significant expansion of those healthcare centers. Secondly, Mr. President, and a lot of other things have been said about what I have on this paper, but one other thing I would like to mention, and it has to do with people who really cannot navigate the system. People who work very hard, they know what they need for themselves. But I was reminded of that when we talked about putting together restaurant owners who will design plans for their members. I would hope that when we started designing plans for the members of small businesses, let's keep in mind that the employees of those small businesses are not negotiating these plans. They are at the mercy of the small business owners, and the question is whether or not the plans are sufficient that they will not fall into the same category that these people with $1,500 to $2,000 deductibles. Finally, Mr. President, this morning I was doing one of these call-in shows on C-SPAN. A gentleman called in, and he was very, very emotional. He said to me that he was getting ready to have transplant surgery, but he was told by the hospital that because he's on Medicare, that his post-operative treatment is going to be limited to 3 years. After that, he'll have to find some way to pay. This man was very emotional today. What we're doing here fixes that, and I do believe that we ought to really be honest with the American people. When we talk about what we are doing with Medicare, we are trying to make sure that Medicare is there for that man and so many others who will find themselves in his position. With that, I yield back, Mr. President.
Okay. I think this has actually been a very useful conversation. What I'm going to do is move on to the next topic, but maybe after we break for lunch and come back, I want to go through some areas where we decided we agreed. I know the abuse is a good example. Some areas where we still disagree. One thing, John, you shook your head when I said that people would be able to choose the better plan because the notion was, well, people are mandated. Actually, any insurance that you currently have would be grandfathered in so you could keep. And so you could decide not to get in the exchange the better plan. I could keep my Acme insurance, just a high deductible catastrophic plan. I would not be required to get the better one. If I chose to get the better one, it would be 14% to 20% cheaper than if I were going into the individual market. I just want to clarify that
issue.
Well,
Mr. President, if I could clarify, that's for a very limited period of time, number one. Secondly, the incentives are set up so that employers would drop you from their coverage because it's cheaper for them to pay the fine than to continue to pay the insurance, so they wouldn't be able to keep what they have. And third, there are still mandates in the legislation as to what you can do with what you have such that it doesn't end up being the same coverage. So with all due respect, I disagree. And it's just a fundamental disagreement between us. Does Washington know best about the coverage people should have, or should people have that choice themselves? Pay a little less, get a little less coverage, or pay a little more and get more coverage?
Can I just say that at this point, anytime the question is phrased as, does Washington know better, I think we're kind of tipping the scales a little bit there, since we all know that everybody is angry at Washington right now. I think it's a good way of framing. It's a good talking point, but it doesn't actually answer the underlying question, which is, do we want to make sure that people have a baseline of protection? And this topic of the insurance market reforms, I think, is a good additional example of what may be philosophical differences, but what we may have in common. Rather than go through the problem, because I think everybody understands out there the issue of people with pre-existing conditions not being able to get insurance, people coming up with bumping up against lifetime caps and suddenly thinking, as a family I met in Colorado, they thought their child was covered, suddenly they hit the lifetime cap and they started having to scramble to figure out how they paid the additional costs. We all are familiar with these examples. I just want to go through areas where I think we agree on insurance reforms, or at least some Republicans and some Democrats agree. I think that we agree on the notion that you can't just drop somebody if they've already purchased coverage. Looking at your bill, John, the idea that you ban rescissions. We agree on the idea of extending dependent coverage to a certain age. Some people say up to 25, some people say up to 26. But we basically agree on that concept. We agree on no annual or lifetime limits. We agree philosophically that we want to end the prohibition on pre-existing conditions. I think the thing we're going to have to talk about is, how do you actually accomplish that? There may be a disagreement as to whether you can do that without making sure that everybody's covered. But that's something that we can talk about. In addition, though, there are some other insurance reforms that have been proposed by the House and Senate in their legislation that I think we should explore. And maybe we can narrow the gaps there and come up with some even a longer list of areas that we agree on. So what I do is, since I want to make sure that Mitch doesn't give me a time clock tally again. Let me first go to Mitch, and I don't know who wants to make the presentation with respect to insurance reform.
Mr. President, I'd like to yield to Dr. Bastani to continue this conversation about insurance reform.
Thank you, Leader Boehner, and thank you, Mr. President. I come at this as a physician, a cardiovascular surgeon with over 20 years of practice doing open heart surgery, dealing with patients who have come to me with very, very challenging cases at very difficult times in their lives. And along with my colleagues, Dr. Coburn and Dr. Barrasso, we bring a wealth of experience in dealing with insurance companies and all these everyday problems that so many American families face. We all agree that we need insurance reform. There's no question about it. The question is, how do we do it? Now, we've all been through a long year, town hall meetings, telephone calls, emails, it goes on and on. And one thing that has become very clear, the American people have spoken out very loudly and very clearly. They want us to take a step back and go step by step with a common sense plan that really brings the cost down for American families and small business owners. They want insurance companies to treat them just like they treat big labor unions and large companies. It's been a resounding message we've heard over and over. So how can we achieve all this? Well, we've talked about some of it. I think one of the things we ought to really look at is, how do you simplify, streamline, and standardize all the paperwork that's involved? Because I can tell you as a doctor, and my two colleagues who are physicians will know, that it takes you away from patient care. It interferes with the doctor-patient relationship. It runs up cost in medical practices, and it's a real issue. So I think we can all agree on that. We need to address that issue. A second area is, how do you really promote choice and competition? We've all talked about it, and I think we've had a lot of discussion already on those issues. We put forth a plan earlier in the year during debate that actually the Congressional Budget Office showed that it brings down the cost of premiums up to about 10%. And actually for individuals seeking and families seeking insurance in the individual market, those cost savings could even be higher. As opposed to the bill we have here, where we've had some discussion already, and Mr. Camp has already outlined, as well as Mr. Kyle, that this bill would actually raise premium cost. We've talked about small business health plans. You know, again, I ran a small business. It was a medical practice. And when I wanted insurance, when those premiums were going up in double digits every year, I'd call an insurance agent. They would come in. And we had very limited choice. Very limited. And the cost kept going up. Small business health plans is one way to really deal with this and allow for pooling. And where our big disagreement is, frankly, with how you do it. And if you create a plan with exchanges that are overly restrictive, it defeats the purpose. And I believe we can have faith in the American public to figure out, if it's transparent enough, what's their best deal? What's the best deal for a small business owner or a family in this sort of arrangement? The same goes for purchasing insurance across state lines. I think I'm glad to hear our Democratic colleagues agree that this is an approach that needs to be taken to promote choice and competition. But again, we feel that this bill restricts those options too much. And we think we can do it in a responsible way. I believe we probably could come together on this. But I think the existing proposals restrict it far too much. Health savings accounts. These are very, very popular among small business owners and families. And I think the one impediment today is the inability to save enough in these. And I think there are ways that we could promote these health savings accounts and promote real savings that will actually make a difference. It won't solve all the problems, but it's an important insurance reform that I think small businesses will really, really jump on if we could expand those savings opportunities. The current bill, as has been stated, add some restrictions and some additional tax provisions on these, which make them less palatable. We all agree on prohibiting insurance companies from arbitrarily canceling insurance policies. That's a no-brainer. There's strong agreement on both sides of the aisle there. Now, with regard to pre-existing conditions, this is an issue that is very difficult, and many of us and our families may have been faced with it. I can tell you I faced it when I closed my medical practice, because I had a health condition, an arthritis condition. And I went to the same insurance carrier that covered my small medical practice for 14 years and got the big red no. can't insure you or your family. Now, that's frankly unacceptable. Now, what we propose is using risk pools, expanding these risk pools, and reinsurance. It's an affordable way to do it. It creates certainty for a family that's faced with this very difficult set of circumstances. Certainty is important. And our plan would not raise premium costs extravagantly, whereas the proposal here would raise those costs, and it doesn't really create the kind of certainty a family needs because they're a waiting list, and that proposal is only temporary to something else that we don't know what it's going to be. The other thing we do is we create a way for small business owners to actually shop and compare apples to apples. Transparency, and this is critical. Our plan does this without creating the kinds of restrictions that we see with the exchange process, and we agree that we have to eliminate annual and lifetime caps, so we have broad agreement there. So again, I think it's clear that the American people have rejected the bills that have gone through so far because they see increases in premiums for families. They see that it raises taxes significantly on families and raids Medicare to create a new entitlement. This doesn't really bring down the cost. This is really not the answer. What American families want is a common sense, step-by-step approach that will really lower the cost for families and small businesses.
All right.
I believe we have a duty to reform health care, but we have an obligation to get it right.
Okay. Thanks, Charles. We're going to go to George Miller, and you know, if you want to respond to specific things that Charles raised or make some more general points, we'll then go back to a Republican. At some point in this discussion, and we're going to have to be a little more disciplined in our time in order to stay on schedule on this section. At some point, I'd like Secretary Sebelius, who is not only a former governor but also insurance commissioner, to address some of the issues that have been coming up around insurance and minimum payments.
Mr. President, George, I don't know if anybody's were told of what the time limits are.
Well, I'm trying to be flexible.
No, I'm just curious if we've got a certain amount of time.
We've got about half an hour remaining for this section. So if people can keep their
Mr. President, from
points
the,
brief.
From the Senate, we have Senator Harkin and Rockefeller respond
right.
for the Democrats.
And I've got a list. George?
Very much. This issue of insurance reform is, I think, where most families intersect with their insurance companies, with the health security of their families. And let's start out with our commonalities in the bill that Congressman Boehner, Leader Boehner, offered on the floor. He agreed that lifetime caps should be abolished, that annual caps should be abolished, that young people should be able to stay on their parents. Plan. I think it was 25. I think in your suggestion, Mr. President, it's 26. So there's that kind of commonality there. But we think that, and our bill goes further than some of the suggestions you've made in the interim since the House and Senate have passed these bills, is that clearly we think that preventative care should not carry a copay with it. That we ought to encourage people to get that kind of preventative care for themselves, certainly for their children. We allow the health savings accounts to continue. That's a variation on, as my colleague talked about, their what they think insurance reform should reflect. Clearly now, when we see the request in California for a 38% increase, in Michigan for 56% increase, I think in Maine it's 27% increase, you've suggested stronger language than we have in either the House or Senate bill, I think along the lines with Senator Feinstein has been talking about in terms of rate review. People are trapped in these systems. But the one area where there still seems to be disagreement, it was not in the substitute offered by the Republicans when we were on the floor, and that is this question of pre-existing conditions, because this is a real trap for families. Either because you find out that you need to go to get care for a disease or an illness, and and you may get a checkup and they may discover that you have arthritis, but you didn't disclose you had arthritis, so now that's a pre-existing condition and you may lose that policy, you may have to provide more. And the fact of the matter is, you hate to admit this at my age, but I sit here with two artificial hips, a little bit of arthritis, and I have a kidney stone. I'm dead in that insurance market if I have to switch policies or switch companies or look for another chance. Now, why should that be? Those hip replacements have been with me for 15 years, and I have no trouble. But it's a way of denying me care. And if you have acne, it's a way of denying you care. In fact, what you see from one of the Blue Cross companies here is 3 pages of things that will keep you out of care, will keep you from changing your jobs. And it goes on and on and on with those back pain will keep you a pre-existing condition, acne that I mentioned, a cleft palate that we talked about earlier here. It means that. So what does that mean when you want to change jobs? What does that mean when you want to start your own company? It means you go without insurance. Or you pay some policy that has a $5,000 deductible or $7,000 deductible. This is a real issue to American families. 56 million people right now have insurance policies where pre-existing conditions can knock them out at any given time. We know that 13 million people were denied coverage over the last 3 years because of pre-existing conditions. And so now you're trapped, you have a pre-existing condition, you can continue maybe with that insurance company if you pay more, but you can't shop in the marketplace for another insurance company, you can't go from Blue Shield to Kaiser because you have a pre-existing condition. You start to see the economic trap and uncertainty that families are confronted with. Now, the interesting thing was, during these negotiations, Senator Dodd and I worked very hard on these issues. Most of the business community signed off on getting rid of these pre-existing conditions. And I think that that's important for us to understand, that that is what real insurance reform is about. Should you still be able to charge women more than men? Should you rate based upon gender? To what extent can you rate based upon ages? What's the essential benefit that we're providing? We can all describe that plan that's really inexpensive, it just doesn't have many benefits that go with it for families. And so I think that this is a very important part of this discussion. I know and when I go home, my district, I hear about this from the people I represent. I hear about this from my wife, and she's talking about our kids and her friends and people she spends time with, how they struggle with these. And what we're really talking about is the manipulation to move people around within the insurance market. And yes, you can go to a high-risk pool. So yes, because you have a pre-existing condition, because I have 2 artificial hips, I can go to the most expensive insurance system in the country. I'm now in a high-risk pool, and I'm trapped in that high-risk pool forever. You can make it a high-risk pool among states. You can make it a high-risk pool among small businesses. You can make it a high-risk pool among large businesses. I'm still trapped in the most expensive insurance because of something that happened to me that I had no control over. I have a cleft child with a cleft palate. I have a child with acne. How can this possibly be? Now, fortunately, in our discussions, as I said, a lot of the business organizations have agreed that these things should be phased out over time. Some can be put in right away, as it's not terribly expensive to cover people 18 to 26, and that can be done right away, and we have that commonality. So I would just hope that we would focus on this issue of what real insurance reform looks like with respect to the impacts on families and individuals as they try to navigate this insurance market.
Thank you, George.
Mr. President, when it turned out, John McCain.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for doing this. And I understand the 4 categories, but there's a big category that the people in my state and across this country are deeply concerned about. And that's not just the product that we are examining today, the 2,400 pages, but the process we've gone through to reach that. Now, both of us during the campaign promised change in Washington. In fact, 8 times you said that negotiations on health care reform would be conducted with the C-SPAN cameras. I'm glad more than a year later that they are here. Unfortunately, this product was not produced in that fashion. It was produced behind closed doors. It was produced with unsavory, I say that with respect, deal-making. The
the Louisiana purchase, funding of $300 million for one state, the Cornhusker kickback, which is, I understand now, been done away with. One of the things that as provisions of this legislation that was particularly offensive was the carve-out for 800,000 Florida seniors exempt from cuts in Medicare Advantage program. There's 330,000 seniors under Medicare Advantage in my home state of Arizona. They're deeply concerned about that. They're deeply concerned about the carve-outs for Vermont, Massachusetts, Hawaii, Michigan, Connecticut. $100 million for a hospital in Connecticut. Why should that happen? They don't understand it. And at the town hall meetings that I conduct all over my state, people are angry. We promised them change in Washington. And what we got was a process that you and I both said we would change in Washington. So then we got into the special interests, whether it be the Hospital Association or the AMA or others, and one of them that was particularly egregious, and I won't go through the whole list, was pharma. Pharma got an $80 billion deal, and in return for which they ran $150 million worth of ads in favor of, quote, health reform. Their over $2 million a year lobbyist was here at the White House and was reported to say in the media, a deal is a deal. And part of that deal was that there would not be competition amongst pharmaceutical companies for Medicare patients. The other, well, among others, was that the administration would oppose drug reimportation from Canada, a proposal that you supported in the United States Senate.
John, can I just finish, please?
Well, and then at Christmas Day, I believe it was Christmas, the majority leader said, quote, a number of states are treated differently than other states. That's what legislation is all about. That's compromise. Compromise is not the word for that. So when my constituents and Americans now who overwhelmingly reject this proposal say go back to the beginning, they want us to go back to the beginning. They want us not to do this kind of legislating. They want us to sit down together and do what's best for all Americans, not just for some people that live in Florida or happen to live in other favored states. They want a uniform treatment of all Americans. So I hope that that would be an argument for us to go through this 2,400-page document, remove all the special deals for the special interests and favored few, and treat all Americans the same under provisions of the law so that they will know that geography does not dictate what kind of health care they would receive. I thank you, Mr. President.
Let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning anymore. The election's over.
I'm reminded of that every day.
We can spend the remainder of the time with our respective talking points going back and forth. We were supposed to be talking about insurance. Obviously, I'm sure that Harry Reid and Chris Dodd and others who went through an exhaustive process through both the House and the Senate, with the most hearings, the most debates on the floor, the longest markup in 22 years on each and every one of these bills, would have a response for you. My concern is that if we do that, then we're essentially back on Fox News or MSNBC on the split screen just arguing back and forth. So my hope would be that we can just focus on the issues of how we actually get a bill done. And this would probably be a good time to turn it over to Secretary Sebelius, who...
Could I just say, Mr. President, the American people care about what we did and how we did it.
Well,
I think we ought, and it's a subject that I think we should discuss, and I thank you.
They absolutely do care about it, John, and I think that the way you characterized it obviously would get some strong objections from the other side. We can have a debate about process, or we can have a debate about how we're actually going to help the American people at this point. And I think that's the latter debate's the one that they care about a little bit more.